begin. Call the meeting to order, the Higher Education and Career Readiness Policy and Finance Committee. And welcome back. We would like to entertain the minutes for March 27th, if we have a motion to that effect.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Peitzman moves the minutes for March 27th. Any questions, corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendments. I mean, the minutes. I've done, I got amendments on them, right, huh? Okay, we've got several bills to deal with today, and before we get to the first one, I do have a little matter of business to deal with here. We had three bills that we passed yesterday, still in our possession, and we would like to reconsider. They were on their way to Ways and Means. They're not there yet. We'd like to reconsider and bring them back to this committee with your agreement for that. So I'll first make a motion to reconsider House File 3852. This dealt with the state grant program. Any questions or discussion? If not, all those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion is approved. And then I'd like to make a motion to reconsider House File 3899. This deals with the universities, a supplemental request. Motion again is to reconsider that. Any questions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That's approved. And then we have House File 3638. Same situation, that's the supplemental request for MinState. Any questions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And that's also approved. All right. Now, we're ready with our first bill of the afternoon. We kind of have a build-up for the very first bill of the afternoon. It's the, although they're all important, but we appreciate when the Chair of Ways and Means comes before us. House File 3817, I bring that up before a committee, and it will be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. So, welcome, Representative Norbach.
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, I'd appreciate it if you would hold it over for possible consideration in your omnibus bill.
Well, we'll do that, too, if that's what you wish.
All right.
All right.
Go ahead. Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 3817 directs the Minnesota State College and University System to not renew their current lease in downtown St. Paul, which expires on July 31st, 2022, and instead requires them to relocate their operations to one or more of their existing campuses. A version of this bill was included in last year's Higher Education Omnibus Bill after an amendment was added in Ways and Means, and it did pass the House, but did not get accepted by the Senate and Conference Committee. I bring this bill forward for the following reasons. First, there would, I believe, in time be some financial savings. The current base lease costs about $2.5 million a year, although with rent increases, that will go up to about $3 million a year in 2022 when the lease expires. It would presumably rise to more than that after that time because, according to MinSCU, the current lease is at a below-market rate. You know, if you go to the upper range of what MinSCU has talked about in a handout they've given me, you'd be closer to $4 million a year. Even if, and I'll talk about the fiscal note later, but I mean, even if you did do everything that was anticipated in the saving in the fiscal note, I believe there'd still be some modest savings each year over renting by doing this. And, of course, once any bonds were paid off, you'd have all the savings of being a land owner, any building owner, as opposed to being a renter. However, and I'll talk about the fiscal note more later, in the fiscal note they talk about building a building. I guess to me, there is a lot of empty space on a lot of these campuses. It would make more sense to be looking at some of the empty existing space for occupancy. Secondly, the current location in downtown St. Paul is actually not all that convenient for people coming to visit. You know, the location in a skyscraper is inconvenient. The parking is not optimum, particularly for a lot of people that are coming in from greater Minnesota. The space itself, if you've ever been there, and I have, is very nice space, located on the top floor of the Wells Fargo atrium. This is a time of budget cutbacks at many Minn State institutions, and I think this extremely nice space contributes to a view that the central office is sometimes out of touch with what's going on in the campuses. Even if they're not, it contributes to that perception, and I think that being on a campus would set a good example for the campuses during this time that demographics and other things are causing enrollment to decline. And finally, I would say that being located on a campus would provide more opportunities for interaction between the central office staff and Minn State board members and Minnesota State faculty, students, and other employees. You know, Eric Kaler, the Board of Regents, the administration at the University of Minnesota is located in Morrill Hall, right next to the Northrop Auditorium on the Minneapolis U of M campus, so it's not a radical idea to have the administration of your system actually located on a campus. And I think that while I do believe that Chancellor Mahatra has done a better job than the previous chancellor about getting out and reaching out to people and trying to visit campuses and make himself accessible, I just believe that being on one or more campuses as opposed to any separate isolated facility in downtown St. Paul would contribute to people in the system interacting better, understanding each other better, understanding the issues they face better, and not having this perception of them being in some sort of ivory tower in downtown St. Paul. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd take questions from members.
Representative Schultz, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many employees would have to move, and where is their empty space? Which campus would you suggest that they investigate for the move?
Representative Knobloch?
Well, Representative Schultz, I would leave that up to them in terms of which campus. They have about 290 employees in the location they have in downtown St. Paul right now. It's 89,000 square feet. It is my assumption that they would want to relocate to one or more campuses here in the metro area. And I, you know, there's quite a few campuses here in the metro area. I don't know that they necessarily all have to locate at the same campus. I mean, there are different functions at the central office. I think about 90 of the employees are IT employees, for example. There are many other IT employees that are actually spread out across the state. I think there's six or eight locations across the state where they've got IT employees right now. I know St. Cloud has some, but there are many other locations that have them too. So I don't know that they necessarily all have to be at the same location, but I believe that there are a number of locations here in the Twin Cities that, because of declining enrollment, have surplus office space that could be considered.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been told that there was a certain legislator, former legislator from Duluth, who always had an issue with the University of Minnesota system being located on the Twin Cities campus. And so I'm wondering if we would face that same issue if they did co-locate with another campus, if other campuses would see that as preferential treatment.
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, you know, certainly that is an issue that if they located at one campus, they would, you know, have potentially some more attachment or familiarity to that campus and people at that campus than if they are not located at any campus. But I think there's an advantage to them actually being on a campus, as I mentioned before, encountering other faculty and students and employees every day as opposed to being in an isolated facility downtown. And I guess I don't know which former legislator that would be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was Mike Yaros.
Oh, all right.
Other questions? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, and probably our fiscal person could answer this question, when it's regarding the fiscal note, this is like state funds to prepare for this transition. Are we able, we used to have like local fiscal notes, I can't remember. Is there a way of finding out what the impact would be to the Minnesota state system?
Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernard, I'm not sure if I completely understand your question. I mean, there is a local impact note that a person can request, although those are usually more requested by people that are interested in the impact of a bill on a local unit of government or number of local units of government.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's answering your question or not.
So, Mr. Chair, so follow up with that one is, you know, when I see the fiscal impact of $285,000, we don't really know what the cost this is going to be to the university as far as moving. It doesn't say that it's going to be in the metro area if you lose talent and there's relocation costs, and it just seems like there's a lot of costs that could be associated with this, and then there possibly could be some savings costs as well. We don't know that. It would just be really nice to know that, and to me it seems like this is more of an executive decision by people who run the universities than the legislature telling them where to relocate, so it's more of a comment, I guess.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, let me just say there is quite a bit, if you look at the fiscal note, beyond the first page that talks about the $285,000, there is some other additional detail behind where Minsky basically, it appears, is saying that they would need to build a new 90,000 square foot building at the cost of 30-some million dollars if we were to do this. I guess I think that even if they did that, I could show you the numbers that there'd be some modest savings. I guess I'm a little bit distressed that their first step in looking at this bill is saying that they need to build a new building as opposed to looking at what other existing buildings they might have on campuses that might be underutilized that perhaps they could, you know, remodel or renovate in a more cost-efficient way. And I guess I would hope and expect that if this would go forward that they would do that. They've got 4 years before the lease expires to, you know, figure out what they would do in terms of space. So they've got plenty of time to prepare for this sort of thing.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what Representative Schultz's question, she's wondering where the available footage, square footage was in the university system. And I see Minnesota State has answered some frequently asked questions because I was interested in knowing those places too. And it looks like, I don't know if this answers, if this is where they're leasing now. I would really like that question answered. So, and maybe this isn't where it is at. What space is available? You mentioned that there's space available at universities. Where are the 90,000 square foot feet available at the Minn State already if they didn't have to build a new building?
That's it, not blocked.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, I guess I don't have that information for each and every campus. I know that a lot of the campuses have had declines in enrollment and thus have had freed up space. I hesitate to say what I'm about to say because I don't think that I'm not introducing this bill to have it move up to St. Cloud's State University or anything like that. It's my expectation that, you know, most of the people that work at this facility work here in the metro area, and so I would expect that they would continue to live here and work here in the metro area. But as an example, I know in St. Cloud, we are in the process of renovating a building that is unused, Eastman Hall, which actually is about 90,000 square feet. And we've got plans for that, I think good plans. I was a sponsor of that legislation. But nevertheless, it shows that there is extra square footage around at different campuses. So again, I want to stress I'm not doing this to have them move to St. Cloud because I would expect that they would be here in the metro.
Thank you for allowing the follow-up. Could we bring Minnesota State down to answer that question for us? I'm guessing they may have the answer.
We do have a spokesperson that's listed as a testifier today.
Oh, I was expecting that they would come down.
Okay. But to answer that question. And Mr. Chair, I just want to make
I think it's fair to say that they are not supportive of the bill.
Okay.
Sure. Vice Chancellor, welcome to the Higher Education Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If it's agreeable to the author and the chair, perhaps we could present our comments, and in our comments you'll hear some reply to the question about location availability.
That's fine. That's good.
Good approach? Sure. All right. Thank you very much. Chair Nornes and members, thank you. My name is Laura King. I'm the Vice Chancellor and Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. With me here today is Brian Yolitz, who many of you know as the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. Thank you, Representative Knobloch, for agreeing to meet with our board chair and our chancellor so that they could convey to the author the strong concerns we have about this bill. We've shared with the committee the background on our current lease. Please know that our relationship with the building management and the City of St. Paul has been the kind of public-private partnership that you all ask us to formulate. It's been a good partnership. It's been good for Minnesota State, certainly, and it's been to the benefit, in our view, of to the state of Minnesota. For just a bit of history for members that that are new to the Higher Ed Committee, at the time of the merger, now 20 years ago, which is in some respects hard to believe, the three former systems had their respective system offices in downtown St. Paul. And they were all consolidated into the space known as CAP Square. And those employees were since moved again because CAP Square was demolished. Remember, CAP Square was right across 394. It was an old, tired building that the state took down. When that happened, the staff there were split between the Wells Fargo location and space in a commercial building in Energy Park, where Metro State also has their teaching space. In 2005, the system office consolidated those two groups of employees into the Wells Fargo location to gain efficiencies, enhance our staff effectiveness, and continue our work supporting both the 11 colleges and universities in the metro area and the balance across the system. The Energy Park lease was terminated. In 2012, we renegotiated the current lease, gave back some space, downsized our footprint, and that is where we rest today in terms of space we have in the building. I would clarify one point the author made. We are in the lowest cost space in the building. We're in the lowest floors, which at the time at which we moved in had never been occupied. The state had a hand in building the Wells Fargo building some 25 or 30 years ago now, and the space we occupied had stood vacant since the building was opened. But we are in the lowest floors and in the lowest cost floors, which was intentional on our part, certainly. And that space continues to serve us well today. It supports our Board of Trustees meetings as well as the Office of the Chancellor staff. The board hosts its meeting in this space, which are attended by all of our presidents, by our bargaining unit representatives, by our student association representatives, and members of the public. The leadership of all of these constituent groups have themselves located their offices in the St. Paul area, mostly within walking distance of this building. We would just point out that we have in the metro area about 40% of our students and 11 of our colleges and universities, and so we are already quite adjacent to a large part of our organization. The location, in our judgment, is an important one because it provides us access to other state agencies with which we have close relationships, Minnesota Management and Budget, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, the Department of Labor and Industry, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Minnesota OSHA, the Department of Administration, certainly access to this building and to your staff and to you, which is important to us. We currently house 300 employees in this space, of which 240 are members of bargaining units, 160 are in MAPE, and 80 are in the other units. This has been our average for the past 5 years or so. Currently, 200 of those employees are affiliated with our Information Technology Group. This is the division that's directly responsible for executing on the next-gen replacement project that we've had several opportunities to talk with you about. This is an information technology system that serves our entire system. They are the human resource capital that supports the very technology that we've brought to your attention and that we seek to replace in the next several years. Mr. Chair, our thanks to you and to your committee for the time that you've given us to talk with you about NextGen and for the support that you've provided for us. You know that we have a great deal of work to do. And let me be really clear about this particular point because it really is keeping me up at night. Our IT employees and the work that they do are embedded in that project, and they're embedded in the work across all of our colleges and universities. In July of 2022, which is the target move date here, we will be in mid-flight, hopefully, on the NextGen replacement project. And the synergy that's present with the location for that project is really critical. Before I turn to Brian and ask him to talk about the process that we'll go through were this bill to become law, I just would like to point out that our current home in downtown St. Paul is in a very favorable location, in our opinion. It's centrally located. It attracts talent from all over the metropolitan area in a very difficult labor market. It offers us good rates, good access, and very useful space in downtown St. Paul, which we have been using in its current form for over 20 years. The City of St. Paul has been a good partner to us, as have the building owners. You will see that the fiscal note narrative does include an assumption regarding capital costs for the move. It's simply not a matter of asking 300 people to check in and take an office, an empty office, or an empty conference room on a campus. We have 300 people and the Board of Trustees that we have to house. We'll certainly continue to talk with campus leadership, but know that so far no president has raised their hand and said, please pick me, come to my campus. Our presidents are in charge of their campuses. They are the leader of the higher education enterprise in their community, and it really is a different dynamic than is present on the metropolitan area campus of the University of Minnesota, where they have a president of the university. Here we have presidents of their colleges and universities and a chancellor, who are really two different roles. So if I could, let me turn to Brian and ask him to just take you through the process that we would undertake were this bill to become law, and address the question that was raised by Representative Bernardi about excess capacity.
Thank you, Ms. King. Mr. Chair, thank you, Laura. Committee, good afternoon. My name is Brian Yolitz. I serve as the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities for the Minnesota State System. I'm here to briefly walk you through the process that we and methodology we've used and intend to use again in assisting our board in exercising their due diligence in providing space for the Minnesota State Central or System Office. In that process, we'll start by reviewing the many aspects associated with providing work environment for the Minnesota State System Office and for its effective functioning and representing and serving our colleges and universities in carrying out the governance and oversight duties called for in statute. We review and validate the central office functions, by which include meetings and operations of our Board of Trustees, associated internal audit and compliance work, the Office of the Chancellor and the System Office units, including Academic and Student Affairs, Finance and Facilities, Human Resources, the Information Technology Group, including the operations and maintenance of the Enterprise Resource Planning System that Vice Chancellor King just outlined. The process considers the business practices and processes associated with these functions and takes into account the eight adjacencies with state agencies and stakeholders such as bargaining units and student organizations, as well as accessibility, transportation, transit, and parking options for staff, students, and our constituent groups. We also look at emerging and best practices around workforce management and flexible and alternative work arrangements to increase employee engagement, effectiveness, productivity, health and satisfaction, all that contribute to employee recruitment and retention. We talk to our presidents and campus leaders and colleagues since they are big users of our space. And we have large meeting rooms and the board's functioning rooms for all its public functions and access to technology, the training rooms, and community engagement activities. In addition, we'll look to a number of resources to compare latest trends in office space management and configuration, including the Department of Administration's standards for office and meeting spaces, as well as those at the federal level, for example, the General Services Administration, GSA, University of Minnesota and other peer higher education systems. Finally, we'll examine whether the current functions and the currently that are currently all located in Wells Fargo Place can be satisfied in multiple locations or can be divided up. And also if that would require construction of new space or the renovation of existing space or some combination of. Recall this approach was tried as part of the system over 20 years ago and abandoned just 5 years after that in order to improve coordination and support the campuses. From their alternatives and how to provide for and meet these, many factors will be outlined and cost modeled for our board to consider. We know that creating administrative space on a campus would require state capital investment and take time, whether for renovating existing space or construction of new or a combination of both. And it'll take away from funding for asset preservation and a renovation of college, university space and labs that we already have and need. Capital investment will be required whether we are moving to one campus or several. I know our campuses and our buildings, and there's not presently any type of office or meeting space that we need, and we're not ready to have, we have to build it or create it one way or the other. This is the basic process that we intend to use and the framework we use as we approach this. It's the same thing we did in 2012 that drove the shrinking of our footprint by over 14% at that time and to the place where we are today. Please note that we found the leasing space in St. Paul offers a couple of important opportunities for us. Flexibility in terms of location and space type and amenities, removing competition from campuses for scarce bonding and operating dollars. Through leasing, we've also been able to structure the leasehold improvements needed to make our space improvements that would otherwise have to come from state capital bonding or other resources that would be located on a campus. Laura?
Mr. Chair, with this insight, I hope you would see that we are of the view that the current statute has it exactly right, that the location of the system office is a decision granted to our board, and that the board would exercise full diligence and care in deciding where to locate the staff and the function. We think this is a decision of some substantial impact, and we would certainly step into it with involvement of our presidents and engagement with the community. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for members of the two testifiers? If not, Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, there's another issue here with the Knobloch bill. Over the last few decades, those of us that have repetitively visited higher education campuses have seen entire buildings now dedicated to administration that were once partially academic but are now full of administration. I would hope that the Knobloch bill would also be an indication that perhaps we could, if this were to become a reality, say that some of these administrators could share duties, that they would both be duties on campus and duties system-wide. And I don't see why they could not. The private education higher ed system does not have an umbrella system over it, and yet its campuses seem to function quite well. So there are some opportunities here, I think, to take a close look at what's happened on campuses with administration and space usage by administration that was once academic.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative Pulaski, thank you for that. I think one of the things that we in the system office haven't done a very good job of, if you'll pardon the dangling participle, is making transparent how much of the work that goes on in that building is campus work. If you think about our technology group, that technology system exists for the campuses. They're the users. The students use it, the employees use it, the staff use it. We just haven't done a very good job of making it obvious how much of the work that happens in Wells Fargo is campus-facing and campus-supporting. I would also just remind us from the information we provided in what we've come to call the Pulaski book. Remember that data book that we've generated at your guidance over the years? What that shows us is that Minnesota State has kept its administrative spending in the lowest quartile in the country because we do things that are enterprise, campus service-based, so that presidents don't have to hire building planners, they don't have to hire their own technology teams. We think we have a terrific story about administrative spending, and we'd love to have an opportunity to come back and share that with you.
Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Vice Chancellor King. Others would interpret the Pulaski book a different way, an interpretation of an explosion of administration, particularly administration at an incredibly high cost, and also an administration that has not been as responsive as it could be to supporting the campuses. The ongoing debate with this administration is, do you support the campuses or do the campuses support you? And certainly when I go back and visit campuses, the message I get isn't that they're being supported by the administration. It's actually the reverse, that the campus has to support the central office, and that's not the way higher education should work. Secondly, for those of us, again, who have had to visit campuses repetitively, or better yet, who have had graduates who've returned to campuses and suddenly see an entire building dedicated to administration, ask questions such as this: how many vice presidents do you need? How many deans do you need? What is a provost? And when you attach a salary and staff support to all of that, you begin to have people who are not happy with their return to the campus. Now, these are individuals who have graduated. Some of them have graduated with both undergraduate and graduate degrees. And the classic line I get is they're tripping over administrators in these buildings, and it wasn't that way when they attended the institution. Some of them took actual courses there, got their degrees in that building, and now the only thing there is administration.
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, I would welcome an opportunity for the committee to have a conversation about this. I appreciate what I'm hearing from Representative Pulaski. I just think we have a different way of we'd love to have a chance to talk about it.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King, you referred to the Pulaski book. I refer to more of what I learned when Lynn Carlson was chairing, and that you do these budgets by the accounts and the numbers, not by members' bills. And that when I requested this information, it was information that was commonplace, frankly, until we had the recession. And then higher ed gave up completely of collecting and presenting this data. So I would hope that the Pulaski book is more of a look at what budgets and accounts do in change orders. Why are we increasing or decreasing an account? Why is an account stable? The understanding of the budgets is critical, and I think we lost touch with that, and we can see it in administration. And again, we don't disagree, and I respect that too, but I also see tuition at an incredibly high level. I see us fourth and fifth in the nation in the amount of debt and the number of students that have to carry that debt, and at some point that's got to be addressed.
Dr. Knobloch, did you have something to add?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't want to interrupt the dialogue with Representative Pulaski and Vice Chancellor King. Please do. All right. But I guess I just briefly wanted to respond to the other statements that were made by saying that, you know, we've got enrollment declines on various campuses of up to 25% or even a little bit more in some cases. If you've got that sort of enrollment decline, I got to believe that there is some space available on campuses. I guess I don't have the magic number of saying I think that you should relocate to this campus or that campus. And frankly, I think that, you know, that is a decision for Minnesota State. If this bill was to go forward, I think that, you know, they gain by making those decisions and having those dialogues. But I certainly believe and know that there are spaces out there that are available now because of the decline in enrollment. I certainly expect that there would be some renovation needed. There would be some cost to moving people. There'd be some rehabilitation of these buildings that they did find that were needed. I don't think that we need to build a brand new 90,000 square foot building. I wouldn't think that we would have to do that. And if that was what was decided to do, I would say that it would be an appearance to me that that the administration hadn't looked hard enough in terms of seeing what other possibilities might be available. But clearly, you know, while that has costs and while we hear them say, you know, while this, you know, Vice Chancellor King says, well, this will cut into HEAP or this is going to take bonding, well, yes, but you're also going to be saving $3 to $4 million a year of cash flow by not having the space in downtown St. Paul. So, yes, you're going to have additional costs, but you're going to have additional savings and money that's available for debt service, too. So I don't, you know, to the extent that you say it's going to cut into HEPRA, I don't think that it's going to cut into HEPRA because you've now freed up cash flow that's available to service debt that you otherwise wouldn't have. So that'd be my response.
Okay. Representative Knobloch, I know we could keep this going for a while, but we do have an amendment. I'm wondering if we'd bring that forward at this time, if the author is interested in offering it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to offer the amendment. I've been in discussion with Representative Knobloch on this bill and on also the amendment. The amendment is House File 4236, and I'm going to speak to it, then I'm going to withdraw it. It was introduced by myself, Representative Poppy, Representative Marquardt, Representative Davids. This amendment has been a discussion point since actually 2013-2014, and now when there is some stability in the Mid-State system, and we have a chancellor that will probably be here for 3 years, I'm just going to describe what it tries to address. In 1983, we took the vocational colleges and we elevated them to technical colleges and we pulled them out of the school districts. The unintended consequence of that was the almost total erosion of hands-on learning in our K-12 systems, and particularly in greater Minnesota. That has continued since 1983. We also now have a critical need for a skilled labor force. So what this bill would say would be for Mid-State to plan a reunification of the technical schools and the K-12 systems so that a Minnesota high school senior could graduate with a skill set that would be employable. This is not a mandate, it's an option. So they'd be able to say, all right, I'm going to get my high school degree, but I'm also going to have a skill set that when I graduate, I can be employed. And I think it answers a number of issues. We have declining enrollment, we know, in higher ed. We have declining enrollment across our K-12 system. I think this answers both in a way of sharing these resources, particularly when you're looking at resources in greater Minnesota that have nothing that a high school could now afford, and yet they're there, they're available. So what this bill simply does is say, plan now to take the tech colleges, somehow merge or fuse them with these K-12 systems so we have a dual-track system so that a high school senior graduating would be employable with a skill set and would have that option through the course of their high school career to be trained to do it. That was the original intent of the vocational schools when they were first created, and I think it's time to go back to the future, and I'll say this. We've had some issues at Mid-State with charting the future. The previous chancellor created this thing, and they spent a great deal of money. I think it's time to chart the present so that we can have a productive future. I would rather see Mid-State work on something like this with our K-12 systems so that we could address a drastic need we have for skilled labor in this state. And also high school students, not all of them should go to a four-year college, but I would like all of them to have the opportunity to have a skill set and be employed. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw the amendment, and we may have this discussion after the break, and I would hope we would, because I think this is something that we really do have to look at in the future.
Thank you very much. I agree with you, that, and we will talk about it in more detail. We're back now to we have House File 3817 in front of us yet, and Representative Jessup has a question.
Thank you, Chair. This question is more probably for the testifier, Ms. King. Ms. King, I'm not that familiar with Mid-State, but I am I am hearing some comments, and I think someone else had echoed in here that, you know, there is a concern that those on the particular campuses look at the administration being in a separate building as like the entities are a little bit distinct and apart from one another. And I can only speak kind of from the business side, but I think also we've seen examples in higher education where the more that all members of a particular entity, you know, business or higher education, are together, the more that that is conducive to the overall relationships between all members of the particular institution. And I do think the separation of the administration in St. Paul relative to not being on a campus, I think there are some concerns there. We could go back and forth on the financials long term, you know, and what's the pros and the cons, and we could come away and still disagree. But when you talk a little bit about the history, we've got 20 years of history. There have been some changes and some pulling together and so forth. And I think of any entity is going to have some strategic plan going forward. And I guess I got a couple of questions, you know, in regard to that. And that is, as the board and as the administration has really looked at a strategic plan, you do have an end date on the lease. Is there at least any discussion amongst the administration of the potential to transition from your current location onto one of the campuses?
Vice Chancellor King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jessup, we absolutely, as part of our run-up to consideration for where we would live on July 1st of 2022, we would examine that question again. We did look at it when we were exiting Cap Square, and we looked at it again when we were coming up for a renegotiation and a lease renewal. I will just tell you that there's really mixed advice in the higher ed community around the country when you talk to folks about where their system office is, and I think it was alluded to earlier. It, on the other hand, it has in other places engendered a sense of favoritism, and this idea that if the chancellor is located on President Knobloch's campus, then President Knobloch's campus gets all the advantage, and everybody else is disadvantaged. So, in other places, it has worked fine. So, it is really a mixed piece of advice for us. But we would certainly ask the question again with the current community of presidents and the current board and the current chancellor as we step into a renewal or a relocation or an extension. I would offer another way to think about this is that having the chancellor and the chancellor's staff in a location that's not affiliated with any campus also sends the message that they serve all the campuses. And we do have 11 campuses right here in the metro area who take advantage of our convenience and our availability. I just had a four-hour meeting with folks this morning that came in from all over the metro area. So you can there's no right answer here. It's just a matter of what's the culture and the community interested in. We would certainly ask and answer the question again as we stepped into another examination of where we would live.
Representative Jessup, follow up.
Just a follow up comment that I would encourage you to no matter what occurs with Representative Knobloch's bill here, I would certainly encourage those discussions to happen on a strategic level. I just think of even this particular building. You know, we've got the legislature, the Senate, the House, and the governor all together on one campus. That isn't always the case in every single state across the country, but I think it serves us well even as we try and interact with one another. Even amidst the disagreements we have, at least the physical location being close together really encourages and fosters greater communication and discussion. And I think that could also be the case for Minn State. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jessup, the only amendment I'd offer to that is that there is one of each of you. There's 37 of us.
I got it.
And so it's just a different a different twist.
Okay, any other questions or final words from the author?
Well, I appreciate the testimony of Minnesota State, and you know, I'd appreciate your support of the bill.
Okay. Then House File, I move that House File 3817 will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or for further action as needed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We have another bill that's before us, but the author isn't here, so we're going to just advance to another bill that I've got, by golly. And House File 3415 before the committee now to be considered for possible inclusion. House File 3415 is a bill that amends the sexual harassment and violence policy statute for public and private post-secondary institutions in Minnesota. It expands a list of provisions that must be included in an institution's policy by adding a requirement that an institution notify a sexual assault victim of campus or local programs that provide relevant legal advocacy services. And it's mostly technical. Apparently, we do have an amendment. And this is a technical amendment. I understand that now mirrors the federal law when we pass this. The amendment is the H3415A2. Known as the A2. Any questions on the amendment? Again, fairly technical. If no questions, all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Okay. I don't think we have any testifiers in the audience, or do we? Yeah, well, there we have. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and I'm just here to briefly offer my support for this amendment. This was actually an idea that came out of Legal Aid, and it's because we sometimes see victims and work with victims of sexual assault and criminal stalking. Sometimes these referrals come to us late, though, and if we could have worked with a victim on a housing issue or on an order for protection, we might have been able to help them a little bit sooner and a little bit more effectively and efficiently. And so right now our referrals are coming mostly from law enforcement, but if we got a referral a little bit earlier, perhaps from the campus, it could be helpful to some victims that need some limited help with civil legal needs. And so this would cover legal aid but other legal resources as well. Thank you.
Questions? Hearing none, any going once? Gretchen Omar. We're waiting for another member to rejoin us. We can do one more bill, so take your time.
All right, in that case, Chair. I don't know if the question would be for the testifier or for you. I just wanted to know where would this list be that would be provided to the victims? How would they be able to access it? And is there a standard list that's being provided in all of the institutions?
Ms. Webster, do you have the answer to that?
Mr. Chair, I don't have the answer. That would probably be higher ed that would be more appropriate to answer that question.
Okay. Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair, Representative Omar, so there's an existing state statute that requires every post-secondary campus, or most post-secondary campuses in the state, to have a policy on campus sexual violence. And so in that, there's also a requirement that policy contains certain provisions. So if you look at the bill, there's sort of a list of 19 things that have to be included in that policy. If you look at the bill on line 2.13, one of the things that has to be included in the policy on campus sexual violence is that notice is provided to a sexual assault victim about the availability of campus or local programs providing advocacy services. And this would just add information about legal services as well. So presumably, if someone were to report an incident of campus sexual violence to the institution, they would have an obligation to provide them with this information about legal aid.
Representative Omar.
Chair, I guess is there like an inclusive list? How do we know what's on that list of what legal advocacy services that are available? Is it the same in every institution, or what would the victim be expecting? I guess is my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Omar, it would be probably up to the particular campus to provide a list of available services that are sort of local to that campus. But I would say that each institution has to have a policy that they will provide this information to someone who reports an incident of sexual violence.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. No more questions? Then I will move that House File 3415 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or for later action. We do have one more bill, and then we have some folks here who want to testify about Life College. I'll take a moment right now to official, or as amended. Okay. I thought I did it, but maybe not. House File 3415, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Okay. And also at the same time, earlier in the committee hearing, we had three bills that we referred back to us, and I'd like to lay over House File 3852, 3899, and 3638. All right. Did we have the... Okay. The next bill is House File 794, and we're waiting for Representative Haley. We maybe could bring the testifiers down if they'd like to at this time, in the interest of time. Oh, there she is. Just in fact.
Wow. Just in time.
You should go right there.
I can do that.
Yep. Got her up.
All right, Representative Haley, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 794.
All right. This would be for possible inclusion.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. You heard this bill last year, and it received broad bipartisan support, but we weren't able to allocate the funding. So we're reintroducing you to this program this year in hopes that with the budget target that the committee receives, that we are able to support student debt. You are all aware that student debt is rising. What I like so much about this bill and this program is that it works. I'm all about personal responsibility. This isn't a bill for loan forgiveness. It's a bill to provide the right supports to help folks better manage their debt and provide student loan counseling so that they keep their credit ratings strong and that they don't default. I'm going to defer to my testifiers to take you through the process of the bill.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Norna, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Rissaby. I'm the Senior Director of Financial Services at Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota. First, I'd like to thank Representative Haley for her work on this bill, as well as the co-authors, Representative Nornis, Lean, Daniels, Heinzman, Jessup, Christensen, Pryor, Zerwas, Whalen, and Bernardi. Today, I'll briefly review how the program works, the key pilot outcomes, and provide an update since the pilot ended, the reasons why this bill is essential to supporting Minnesota student loan borrowers and our state's economy. 14,000 Minnesotans a year defaulted on their student loans in the last report from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Defaulting on student loans is devastating on a borrower's financial life with major impacts on credit scores. Nearly all of these defaults could have been prevented through various repayment options, such as income-driven repayment, consolidations, if people understood them, and move forward with the option that best fit their situation. Failure of student loan servicers to assist borrowers to understand their options And student loan settlement frauds and scams that have been increasing in our state has left Minnesota borrowers struggling to navigate these mazes of repayment options and scams. As a result of the legislation passed in 2015, 1,673 borrowers were served between October 15, 2015 and June 30, 2017, from 73 different counties in Minnesota. After counseling, 99.5% of current borrowers remained current a year later after counseling. 98% developed a monthly budget plan, and 67% increased their credit score by an average of 45 points. The full report and the one-pager you received has additional information regarding the program and additional pilot outcomes. Borrowers meet in person or over the phone with a certified financial counselor who has received intensive training in both the technical aspects of distressed student loans and behavior change counseling techniques. Counseling is provided to borrowers regarding their complete financial situation, pulling credit reports, deep budgeting, addressing income, expenses, debts, including housing and credit card debt, as well as understanding all the federal, state, private student loan that are owed by the borrower and the repayment options that are available to them based on their personal situation. Then an action plan is developed that includes sustainable changes in financial practices and prioritizes student loan repayment. Since the pilot ended last year, we've had to stop outreach for this service, and yet we continue to see the demand, as well as receive requests to review our pilot outcomes report from the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington, D.C., and results were shared with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Out of all the national and local conversations regarding the issues around student loan debt, we can be proud that Minnesota is working on a solution to address this challenge. We've worked to diversify other funding to continue to operate this program. We continue to try and serve people by piecing together funding from different local funders and employers, but have not been able to provide coverage across the state. We believe the state of Minnesota is part of the solution to provide broader information and access to the service to all borrowers who are struggling. Recently, the Federal Trade Commission issued a warning regarding student loan repayment scams on the rise. One example of this is detailed in the pilot report, and we continue to see these increasing all over our state in different communities. There's great demand in our communities for this service. We continually hear from loan officers, realtors, and individuals that student loan debt is holding people back from home ownership, and as well as people aspiring to start their own small businesses. We hear from employment counselors and people working in workforce development that it's holding people back from returning to college to finish their degrees when they have old student loans in default or student loan debt holding them back. We hear from financial aid offices at schools they do not have the time and depth of resources to assist borrowers. With continued funding, we can serve more aspiring homeowners, aspiring business owners, provide additional outreach and service in rural areas and communities of color, and further expand the service to people throughout Minnesota who are struggling with student loan debt. By providing borrowers with the information and trusted support needed, we can prevent student loan debt from inhibiting the growth of Minnesota's economy and derailing the borrowers' life goals for which they sought higher education in the first place. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the benefits of the service.
Thank you very much. Ms. Grimes, are you next?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Trisha Grimes. I am now a volunteer with Lutheran Social Service, but if I look familiar, it's because for many years I was the legislative liaison for the State Office of Higher Education. And many years before that, I was a nonpartisan fiscal analyst for the Minnesota House at the beginning of my career. As I was getting ready to retire, I learned that Lutheran Social Service was doing student loan counseling, and I got excited right away at the possibility of this being a volunteer opportunity for me. I actually volunteer in a number of different ways in the community now that I am retired, but this is my highest priority, volunteer activity. And that is because it drives me crazy that there are so many borrowers who are defaulting on loans or getting very late in their payment on their loans and having major damage to their credit, when all of that could be prevented if they just understood their options. Depending on when a borrower attended school and took out their loans, there can be 56 different options for repayment under the federal student loan plan. It can be very puzzling and overwhelming for a borrower to understand which of those 56 options is the best for them. Lutheran Social Service, one of the reasons I was so excited about it is that I had known for years that the University of Minnesota Boynton Health Service has Lutheran Social Service come and provide counseling for students who have credit problems that are inhibiting their ability to continue and do study and finish their degrees. They've done that for many years, and in typical University of Minnesota fashion, they did research on which credit counselors had the best record of actually getting the borrower back on track and able to be more functional financially. And that was Lutheran Social Service. So it's very important to continue to help borrowers with this. For a modest investment of $250 per borrower, counseling sessions of one or two counseling sessions, these borrowers are improving their credit scores by 45 points. That's in 6 months to a year, that's a very remarkable increase in a borrower's credit score. Usually it takes years for damage to a credit score to be made better. 720 is an average credit score for Minnesota. You get 90 days behind on your loan. This is not even defaulting. It's 100 points on a credit score. At a credit score of 620, it can be hard to rent an apartment, to get a job, to buy a car, all kinds of things. So we have 14,000 people a year that attended Minnesota institutions that are defaulting on student loans. Many of those borrowers do not know that they can rehabilitate their loans and remove the damage or begin to ameliorate the damage that that default did to their credit score. If they knew, they could get on an income-driven repayment plan, make payments for 9 to 12 months, and then their loan is considered rehabilitated, that no longer damages their credit score. In addition, defaulting on a student loan is a workforce issue. There are many borrowers who attended for a semester or two and never finished a degree. They never got a better job, and they are stuck with the student loan payments. They may actually owe a rather modest amount, but they have trouble affording the payments. If they defaulted, they cannot get federal or state student aid to go back to school and finish that degree and get that credential that will help them meet labor force needs in our economy. If they get the right kind of financial counseling, they can get on track and in a year or two be in a position to go back to school and get that degree and be able to get a better job in the workforce. I really urge you to support House File 974.
Members, questions? Representative Haley?
I'd appreciate your support. Thanks for the time.
Okay. Hearing no other questions or discussions, and I now lay over House File 794 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill for further action at a later time. Thank you very much. We have some folks here that are going to be testifying about or telling us all about Minnesota Life College. They've been waiting very, very patiently. And we don't want them to be nervous. Right? Yeah, just be relaxed, just like the rest of us. These folks were in my office earlier today, so they seem like they're my friends. Aren't we? Yeah?
I hope so.
But we're looking forward to this presentation. And just take a minute to get technically hooked up.
Is it on?
Yeah. Very nice.
There you go. WDLCLMD2013.
Say it. We might be back next year.
Okay, it looks like we're getting close to showtime. Who's the first person to speak?
Chair Nornes and committee members, for the record, my name is Amy Goodmisted. I'm the executive director at Minnesota Life College. Thank you for giving us time today in your busy schedules to say thank you for your support of Minnesota Life College and to give you some more information about who we are, what we do, and to meet some of our great students. I would also like to give a special thank you to those of you who are able to attend our gala on Saturday night. It was great to have you there with us, and we greatly appreciate your time. Minnesota Life College is a lifelong learning program for individuals on the autism spectrum and with other learning differences who want to lead an independent life and contribute to our communities. 1 in 68 children is on the autism spectrum, but this is not just a childhood disability. These are individuals and families who are faced with significant challenges as they reach adulthood for finding a right place for them to reach their full potential. Young adults on the autism spectrum and other learning differences represent a group at risk. Individuals with autism spectrum and learning differences are currently underrepresented in the workforce. Only 1/3 of them have any kind of post-secondary education. Less than a half have held any kind of paid employment within 4 years of graduating from high school. 87% continued to live with their parents after high school. And 24% are considered socially isolated, meaning they have not had contact with anyone outside of their family for over a year. All of these factors greatly diminish their chances to obtain competitive employment. And this is the stark reality for individuals on the autism spectrum and with learning differences. However, I am proud to say that this is not the reality of MLC students and members. With 126 graduates, I am proud to say that 90% of them have achieved independence and never returned to live in their parents' homes. With the national employment rate for individuals on the autism spectrum and learning differences being only at 10%, MLC's vocational program blows that stat out of the water. Our CLP members have an 83% employment rate and an average length of employment from over 3 or more years. In fact, this year, we have 100% of our graduating seniors already employed, and they graduate in May. Our mission at Minnesota Life College is to transform the lives of these individuals and their families. Since 1996, MLC has been creating a community and providing the necessary resources for independence by educating individuals on how to transition from high school, by educating them on how to transition from high school, living with their parents, and be able to live independently, gain employment, and live to their full potential. Our curriculum, we provide the core competencies to fill learning gaps that prevent employment and independent living for so many adults. We tackle independent living skills, employment skills training, and social integration with a holistic approach. At MLC, students discover their strengths and identify their challenges and develop the necessary strategies for living independently after graduation. We provide our students career skills training certificates in partnership with Century College. Right now, these certificates are a culinary certificate, retail certificate, and a hospitality certificate. And we assist them in securing and maintaining meaningful employment. This is not a program at graduation day where we say, best of luck and send you on your way and never check in again. We believe that building a strong sense of community, not only for our students, but for our graduates, is critical to their continued success, which is why we created the Community Living Program. Our Community Living Program is a lifelong program that provides members apartment living coaching, career support, and over 80 structured social activities each month. We are also providing their families with stable communication, structure, and guidance as we continue to serve as an integral role in their long-term independence and success as graduates. Our CLP members all live nearby our campus, which is located in Ridgefield, right across the street from Best Buy headquarters. I'm so proud of our graduates, most of whom are now members in the CLP program. And because I don't live very far from MLC, I get to see them in action. I get to be a part of their community, and they are naturally a part of mine. When I do my grocery shopping at Lund's, I will always go to Andy's register. And when I get my gas at Super America, I will run into Trevor or Paul. And when my family goes out to eat, we'll see Piper at Pizza Luce or Anna and Sally at Panera's. And, of course, it would not be a night at the movies if Chris didn't take our tickets at Southdale AMC. And whenever I need anything from Walgreens, Corey is there to provide fantastic customer service. At MLC, we believe that everyone deserves the opportunity to discover their full potential and to live a vibrant life. At this time, I would like to introduce you to a couple of our students and let you hear their story.
Okay. Welcome, and just state your name for the record. And
hi, I'm Andrew Shostrom. I was here last year.
State your last name again.
Shostrom.
Shostrom, okay.
It's Swedish.
It is.
Yeah. It means something with water.
Oh.
No, exactly what. Thank you for giving us the time today to thank you. Your decision to support MLC last year for the budget was huge. It gave me and a bunch of my friends the tuition assistance that we needed to complete the program in May. I'm proud to be working at Super America. I'm one of 7 MLC graduates working at Super America. Not the same one, though. I love having a job to go to every day. Sometimes not at 6 in the morning.
How often is that?
Monday through Friday, so I have to every day, but I don't want to. I'm graduating in May, and I mean, going to classes and learning the skills that I need is important, but honestly, the chance to be, independent from parents is better. And before coming to MLC, I knew I was capable of doing things, but I needed a little more practice, like laundry and that stuff, like holding a job. But I'm happy to say that, like, the last 3 years have been great, and thank you for all that you.
All right, thank you. How does work and the classes go? I mean, how many hours do you work?
Unlike many schools, like I've been to a couple that, or I've been to the schools that I've been to, my friends have to deal with that more, but here it's like we do the schooling around your work schedule, so if like you miss a class, that's okay, and then you'll like get caught up some other time when you're not working, like in high school, they had to go to school and then wouldn't get paid as much then. So then there obviously makes crabby students at school because they're not getting paid as much.
Good. Well, thank you. Members may have questions, but maybe we'll move on to the other student here, too, that hear his story.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Hi, my name is Michael Fuel. I have never spoken at a committee meeting like him before. Or her. However, I was the speaker at MLC's gala last weekend where I shared my story with 800 guests at the event. It was just slightly bigger, and I can tell you, it was awesome. Some of you may have had a chance to attend the event, and I thank you for sharing your Saturday with us. And for those of you who missed it, I would say I did a really good job. And you missed out on such a great event. I shared with the guests my struggles in high school. I did not have a lot of friends, and I pretty much did not speak to anyone. I stayed at home and in my basement, my bedroom, alone, for a year. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do after high school. I mean, all the other kids were going off to college, but that wasn't any option for me. My mom, who is always doing research on something, found Minnesota Life College 3 years ago, and my life changed. Suddenly, I was surrounded by people who understood me, that liked to talk with me, and hang out. And then I started to get opportunities to learn things that I had never had access to before. After taking a leadership class that prepared students for summer camp jobs, I was hired as a junior counselor at True Friends Camp. It was awesome. The class and the work experience taught me two important things. Work stamina is one. Work stamina is important, and now I am prepared to work long hours and do lots of different kinds of jobs during one shift. And two, being a counselor for little kids made me really reconsider when I might want to have them. Sorry, parents. Now, in my senior year, I got a job at Great Wolf Lodge Water Park as a retail and attractions attendant. I've been working at Great Wolf for over 4 months now, part-time, about 30 hours a week at minimum. My responsibilities include helping customers at a shop, explain how to pan for gold. There really is a secret to it, folks. Working at a cash register, redeeming prizes in the arcade, arcing people on the rock wall, and supervising the ropes course. In fact, I even worked housekeeping. At this point, I basically say, it's not where I am, it's just, I just go, and I'm like, where do you want me now? My recipe for working at long hours and surviving somehow, others, they don't get me, are coffee, energy drinks, and Kickstarters. Yes, there we go. But somehow we won't tell my healthy living teacher that. Knowing that the staff at Great Wolf Lodge are happy with my work feels really good. It is great to know that people appreciate me and are counting on me. I am glad that I got to come and speak to you today and to say thank you for your support of Minnesota Life College. Thank you.
Thank you. Both of you are very well spoken. And members have questions of these two young men at this point. Representative Albright.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do have a question for the testifiers, but it strikes me as odd, but I think I recognize someone else at the testifiers table today, and I don't know if...
The shy one.
I just was wondering if she might, you know, present herself and identify who she is.
Yeah, who are you?
I think that's very appropriate.
Chair Norness, Representative Albright. It's nice to see you. My name is Kaylee Tate for the record, and it's good to be back.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I don't have so much as a comment, but both Michael and Andrew can comment on it. But I wanted to thank Andrew for coming up again this year. He was here last year. He made us all mindful of the work that MLC does, and he also made us laugh, too. Swedish and all. And for Michael, you are a true inspiration. I attended the MLC gala on Saturday night, thanks to Ms. Tafe, and I can only say in all seriousness that it was one of the highlights of this year. So thank you for what you're doing, Amy, and thank you for what you're doing to encourage all of us to support you in your endeavors. So thank you very much for MLC.
I was invited to the gala, and I couldn't make it. at a birthday party, my own, so I had to go. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Minnesota Life College, thank you for the amazing work you're doing. And thank you to the students for coming and sharing with us. And, the gala, I'll second you, the gala was much better than this committee hearing. No disrespect, Mr. Chair. This is a great committee. I understand, Mr. Chair. But, members, this is, and they're doing outstanding work at Minnesota Life College. And the $2 million we allocated over this biennium is the best $2 million that the legislature spent in this biennial budget. And frankly, it's not nearly enough. Mr. Chair, and I'm looking forward to, in the future, talking about new ways that we can support Minnesota Life College.
Representative Zubrod.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I just want to thank the MLC group for coming. I had the opportunity and distinct honor last session to carry this bill, and I'm excited to see what the work of the legislature and this committee specifically is doing to help not only these students, but all the students at the MLC. And all members received a save the date for the Minnesota Life graduation on Saturday, May 12th at 9 in the morning, and would encourage members to attend. It's pretty inspirational.
Sounds like a good idea. Any other questions, comments? Guests have more comments, more speeches, jokes?
Chair, we do have a video we'd like to share. Our students would like to be here. We have many other students, but they are all on spring break.
Okay, well, we look forward to that.
Get spring break because they're working. So we thought we'd share a video with the committee today.
Okay, sure. We're ready.
Please pause for technical difficulties.
Quarter is just getting ready for graduation and getting ready for moving. So we've been talking a lot about how this is the point, right? Once you graduate, where the rubber meets the road. It's where you take the skills that you've learned and you put them into practice. Think back on all the skills and tips that you've learned since you came to MLC.
I've been at MLC for a couple of months. To be honest, I don't make eye contact with all that much, or it's not as much as I thought I did. My conversation skills aren't as good as I would have guessed back when I was at home.
I came to MLC not dependent on my parents all the time for everything. Like, I want to know how to do stuff independently and stay focused on what you're doing and not get distracted by something else. Be confident about doing it.
Feeling happy seems like it's next to impossible. Some people with depression, they can be led to becoming victims of suicide. And unfortunately for me, that almost became the case when I was 17. I struggle a lot with simple routine tasks that everyone does every day, but yet they're so hard to do for some reason.
I helped to work on my anxiety and friends. I love my better friends. I think what will change about myself is that I'll become more comfortable in myself, my own skin.
Today we're going to talk about
about personal space. Small talk.
Balancing checkbooks.
Groceries.
Team building.
Dodgeball.
So, where's your middle stop at?
Peter, I can do it.
I just accepted a job offer today.
I came here and water the flies in the middle of an island with three other people. We gotta figure out how to, build a shelter and all of that. So we did. Up until 6 months ago, I tended to assume that people problems could be fixed and there was a simple solution. All you had to do was screw a thing back in or glue this thing onto that thing. I've only just recently realized that it doesn't always work that way, and a lot of times it's a lot more complicated. Junior year, Aaron said we're having a showing at the U of M, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever, and I won't learn hard at it. Watercolor has taught me that you can make the most beautiful painting in the world, and there's always going to be one thing you could have done to make it slightly better. And people are like that too. Once you realize that there is no perfect human being, it becomes a lot easier to just accept that that's okay. I have a friend who has certain flaws that really annoy me, but I guess it kind of occurred to me one day that she would be the same person. I don't think I'd really like her all that much if said flaws were fixed. Living on my own outside of MLC is going to be pretty hard at first, but I came to MLC so I could learn to live independently. I feel like I'm about 90 to 95% there.
Well, I still pretty much become more social since freshman year. It's fair to say that I bond with other people by talking about the game, football, and baseball, and hockey. Tim and Matt, they're sports guys, and they know a lot about sports. Yeah, once in a while I go to basketball games. I like to see the mascot and see them shoot the t-shirt cannons. It's awesome that everyone's such good people and that they bring like so much happiness to everyone. I finally got a job at ESSA, and this past February, it's been 1 year since I've been there. And every 6 months, I get a pay raise there after I graduate. Goals for the future are to work 40 hours there and balance social life and work. I can say I'm 100% excited, times 10.
Last year, I struggled a lot with being happy with myself and with who I am. My teachers would have to come and wake me up to get me to classes, but that doesn't happen anymore because I'm a lot better at time management. If I go to class, if I work hard, if I keep up with my daily tasks and chores, I'll be able to accomplish that eventually. My job coach helped me find a job at Joann Fabrics. I was very excited when I found out that I got the job. I sort of almost cried a little bit. I was so excited. I told everyone. A lot of my decisions have been centered around finding the ideal balance for myself, keeping myself occupied but not so much that I'm ripping my hair out. As a freshman, I was afraid of confrontation. If I had a problem with someone, I would usually just keep it to myself and let it bottle up. Last week, we had conflict with keeping up with apartment chores. So we just sat down and discussed ways to solve the problems. People like each other a lot more when you respect them. My friends and my advisor and my teachers taught me how to be independent, and that makes me feel a lot better about myself.
And life is like a box of chocolates, honestly. It's what it feels like, just of having all these people around me to support me, and having all these friends that I can hang out with, and having a job, and having roommates who support me. It's just been a great experience. I'm in a photography elective in school here. I like to shoot nature pictures, as well as architectural in the area. I just started working at Pizza Lucha in Richfield, and I really, really enjoy it. The people there are so nice. My last job's didn't work out as well because I just had a lot of anxiety, and it wasn't the right atmosphere. I have a sensory club that I started through the school, a place for students to de-stress themselves so that we can practice figuring out what helps us calm down, what helps us work with each other. I feel like I've become more of an advocate for myself, and I feel like I've been able to be more independent, definitely. If I had a time machine and I could go back in time and tell myself something before freshman year, what I'd say to myself is, don't be afraid, MLC is fine. It's a new adventure.
Very well done.
Chair, we transform lives every day at MLC. We are passionate about our mission, and we are proud we can't even describe how much we feel, how proud we feel about our students and graduates. But as you can imagine, our work comes with many challenges. One of them are the high costs of providing lifelong educational program to our students. Our program is costly and our tuition is high. We do everything we can to create financial aid and scholarships for our students so they can afford MLC. But the challenge is great. In the past, the only way we were able to fund our mission of lowering students' tuition was through fundraising at our annual gala, which was able to barely cover the needs of our families. On average, we'd be able to cover about 20% of their need, which was a deal breaker for some families. And retention rates year after year were low because families could not afford to continue to pay. But because of you, we were able to meet the needs of families up to 50%. And for some families who had full need, they were able to get 50% of their tuition covered. And for the first time in a long time, we have had 100% retention rate this school year. You gave us the most amazing gift. I wish you could receive all the calls and emails we got back from parents when they saw their financial aid package come through this year. To hear their stories about how badly they were struggling to pay their bills, and what their new financial aid meant to their families. Not only are you changing lives for the better for our students and families, the state of Minnesota is also greatly benefiting from your investment in MLC. A study in 2014 by Gemma Pediatrics reported that the cost of the individuals with ASD, or autism spectrum disorders, was about $2.4 million over their lifetime. I am sure with inflation that number has grown. At MLC, we believe that we save the state $3 million in services that our graduates do not use, the contribution they pay back to the community from being a renter or a homeowner and not using supported living services, as well as what they give back by being competitively employed. While our program is small now, I can honestly say that every graduating class will put at least $45 million over their lifetimes back into the state of Minnesota. On behalf of everyone involved at MLC, I truly cannot thank you enough for your financial support and assure you we do not take this support for granted and are fiscally responsible with every dollar we spend. We would love to have you visit our campus and also have distributed save the dates to our upcoming graduation ceremony, which will be a remarkable event. Both Andrew and Michael will be graduating in May. And we also noticed on the cover of today's Star Tribune a fascinating article about what's happening in the state of Minnesota with individuals with disabilities, and we're really proud to say that we're pretty much the opposite of what's happening in that article. So thank you again, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
That article was handed out, I believe, to the members?
Yes, it was.
Any comments, questions from members? We really appreciate you being here, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
Hearing no questions or comments, again, you did exceptionally well, and we will again see you at a later time, but right now our meeting is adjourned.